Welcome to the 3VB podcast series, 3VB Speaks. This podcast is concerned with the question of who has standing to make applications to court under company and insolvency legislation. Andrew Sutcliffe KC and William Day have together appeared in a number of recent cases on that question, culminating with a successful appeal to the Supreme Court in Brake and Cheddington, where a bankrupt purported to challenge the actions of their trustee in bankruptcy in respect of bankruptcy assets. Andrew Sutcliffe KC is a long-standing commercial silk, regularly appearing in the commercial court and offshore jurisdictions, advising in complex, high-value disputes. He practices across the whole range of commercial disputes, with a focus on banking and finance, commercial and financial fraud, and corporate insolvency disputes. William Day is a versatile junior whose practice spans all aspects of commercial litigation and arbitration, including banking, insurance, fraud, and insolvency work. In the insolvency and restructuring market, Will is regularly instructed to advise on and argue complex and novel issues, and much of his insolvency work has a civil fraud or asset recovery angle.
So, Andrew, this is something we've wrestled with, I think, for about 5 years. It may help at the start just to explain to listeners what this issue is all about. So quite often, provisions of the Companies Act or the Insolvency Act create a liberty to apply for directions or for some form of relief in respect of a company or in respect of insolvency proceedings. But those provisions don't expressly state who is entitled to make that application. And so on the face of it, anyone on the street could walk into court and interfere with corporate affairs or with an insolvency process. But a number of cases over the years have sought to confine those who can make those applications. So the first case we did, I think, together was Core VCT. Do you want to explain what that was all about?
Yes, absolutely, Will. These were companies used as fund vehicles for investment in SMEs, with the shares in those companies being sold to retail investors. The funds performed below expectations, but were solvent. They were wound up in a member's voluntary liquidation, and a few of the shareholders who had small stakes in those companies wanted to investigate the fund manager's conduct. With Sophie Mallincrott, Will and I applied successfully to the company's court to restore the companies to the register and appoint new liquidators. Our clients were then faced with an application by the fund manager to remove the new liquidators from office and put the companies back into dissolution. We conceded the applicants had standing as members of the companies to make the application, but argued that because of the adverse interest principle, most authoritatively stated by Lord Millett in Deloitte and Touche back in 1999, they lacked standing as they were the people under investigation. The company's court judge accepted this argument and dismissed the application, refusing to remove the newly appointed liquidators. Part of his reasoning was that the application could be seen as an attempt to thwart investigation into their own conduct. The Court of Appeal took a different approach. They kept the companies restored to the register and the new liquidators remained in place, but the members had to vote on the proposed investigation. Lord Justice David Richards said he did not think it was necessary to enter into the debate as to the adverse interest principle, save to say that he was not persuaded there was anything as elevated as a principle at work here. The next case we want to consider is the case of Brake and Cheddington. This was a case which, on one level, was a case about a picturesque cottage in Dorset. But on another, it demonstrated the difficulties which arise when a trustee in bankruptcy is trying to sell the assets of the insolvency and is faced with difficult and litigious bankrupts in their bankruptcy and contributories in a partnership liquidation. A sign of how litigious these bankrupts were is that the litigation has spawned no fewer than 49 judgments in total so far, with two reserve judgments still awaited. And they included five High Court trials, four appeals to the Court of Appeal, and one outing to the Supreme Court. The issue was whether the Brakes, Mr. and Mrs. Brake, had standing, where the relief they sought would have no impact on their position within the bankruptcy. The Brakes challenged the actions of the trustee and issued an application to set aside the sale of the property to Cheddington under Section 303 of the Insolvency Act. Cheddington said they had no standing in the application and that it should be struck out as there was no prospect of any surplus in the bankruptcy. Judge Paul Matthews acceded to that application. The Court of Appeal reversed his decision, and so the matter then went to the Supreme Court. And Will, could you just explain what happened then?
So when we got to the Supreme Court, we were faced with Lord Richards, as he had then become. So having seen him express some scepticism about what we described as the adverse interest principle in the Core VCT case, we had to develop our case based on the same authorities to come up with something slightly different. And so what we focused on instead was the idea of having a legitimate interest in the relief being sought, which was also part of Lord Millett's reasoning in Deloitte and Touche. And we said that the Brakes had no interest as bankrupts in the relief they were seeking because it wouldn't make a difference to the outcome of the bankruptcy from their perspective. They had no legitimate interest and therefore they shouldn't be entitled to interfere with the course of the bankruptcy. Now, that argument was successful. Lord Richards accepted it. And in the course of his judgment, he identified what he described as three categories of persons who can apply to interfere in a bankruptcy or indeed a corporate insolvency. In any case, and he described those as being firstly creditors, where they're applying in their capacity as creditors. So in other words, to seek relief that will impact their position as creditors. Secondly, bankrupts or contributories, such as shareholders, but again, only where the relief will impact their position. So that would require them to show a surplus or a prospect of a surplus if the relief were granted. And then thirdly, a very limited number of cases where the applicant doesn't fall into one of the first two categories, but they're able to point to something unique having happened within the insolvency process that would entitle them to interfere in what's happened. And Andrew, it might be helpful just to take those three categories in turn before we explain how that then led to the outcome in the appeal. So starting with bankrupts and contributories, we really focused on two cases in the Supreme Court. The first was Dodwell. Do you want to say something about Dodwell?
That's right. Dodwell is a fairly old case decided by Mr. Justice Charles Harmon in 1949. And Dodwell, a discharged bankrupt, brought a motion under the precursor to Section 303, challenging the trustee in bankruptcy's administration of his large property portfolio, seeking an injunction to restrain the sale of those properties. And he took issue with such matters as the trustee's remuneration, sought to prevent any payment to the Inland Revenue, and sought an order that the properties be treated as constituting a surplus which would revest in the bankruptcy. The trustee straight away took a standing point, arguing that the bankrupt couldn't interfere in the administration of the estate until a surplus of the assets was in existence. The judge agreed with that argument and he made it very clear that it was only where a bankrupt could show there is or would or might, but for the trustee's action or inaction, be a surplus in the trustee's hands after satisfying in full all claims of creditors that the bankrupt had standing. That was the first case we relied on. And Will, do you want to touch on the second?
So the second, I think, was more straightforward, but is another example of how a bankrupt might benefit from a bankruptcy. So in Engel and Perry, the argument wasn't that there may be a surplus, but rather that the bankruptcy should be annulled. The bankruptcy should never have taken place. And the court was satisfied that there should be an annulment. But one of the conditions under the legislation for an annulment is that the trustee in bankruptcy has their remuneration paid up to the point of annulment. Now, the trustee had incurred a certain amount of WIP, if I can put it that way, and the bankrupt argued that the trustee had spent too much time on the bankruptcy and therefore shouldn't have to pay in the amount that the trustee was claiming. And the court was satisfied in that case, it was Mr. Justice Ferris, the bankrupt would have standing to challenge that form of officeholder activity because it went directly to him getting something out of the bankruptcy, i.e. bringing it to an end. So those are the sorts of cases in the past, before the Brake case, where bankrupts had been able to interfere in their bankruptcies. It may help next to consider Lord Richard's second category, which was the test of legitimate interest insofar as it applies to creditors. Now, here, obviously, the court takes a much more generous approach because the purpose of an insolvency process normally is to benefit creditors. Now, there were two particular Court of Appeal decisions that Lord Richards focused on, indeed we focused on in our arguments, which were Eden Note and Eden Gate. Andrew, do you want to say something about Eden Note first?
Yes. That was a case in which three creditors applied to set aside the sale of an asset by the liquidator on the grounds that the sale was at an undervalue. And the applicant said that if they had been offered the opportunity, they would have been willing to pay a higher price. And their standing was challenged by the liquidator. And the Court of Appeal held that because the sale was alleged to have been at an undervalue, and they were creditors of the company, it was in their capacity as creditors of an insolvent company that they had standing to make that challenge. But they would have lacked standing if they were simply disappointed prospective purchasers of the asset without being creditors. And do you want to take the second case, Will, which is Eden Gate?
So Eden Gate raised the same issue about dual capacity. So what's interesting, I think, Andrew, about both those cases, and the reason why they've featured quite heavily, I think, in our argument and in the judgment, was that they show that the court doesn't just look at technical capacity. So it's not enough just to say, well, I am a creditor, so therefore I can interfere. The court is focused, as Lord Millett said in the Deloitte case that we mentioned earlier, on the substantive position, the true capacity in which someone is applying, and the basis on which they are interested in the relief that they're seeking. And that also has come up in Lord Richard's third category. So you'll recall at the beginning, I mentioned there was a third small category of cases where someone who is not a bankrupt or a contributory nor a creditor can sometimes have standing to interfere in the process of an insolvency. And that obviously loomed large in our case because the bankrupts placed heavy reliance on that third category is justifying a wider approach. And the two cases that really attracted argument were called Rehan's Place and Woodbridge.
Yes. If I can take Rehan's Place, that was a case where a liquidator had exercised the power conferred on him under the Insolvency Act to disclaim by notice onerous property, which in that case was a lease that the company held. And after the notice of disclaimer had been served on the landlord under the lease, the landlord applied under the equivalent section in the Insolvency Act, Section 168, Subsection 5, for an order that the disclaimer be set aside on the grounds that it had the effect of terminating, as regards future liabilities of the company, a guarantee given by a third party. And we sought to rely on those facts to argue that the landlord was in fact a contingent creditor, and so he fell within the category of creditors who had a legitimate interest to bring a claim to and would therefore have standing. But Lord Richards was not, I think, persuaded by that argument, and he said that this case fell into that small third category, and the landlord had standing because disclaimer was a procedure uniquely available in a liquidation, and it involved the exercise by a liquidator of a power specific to his position as liquidator, which directly affected the landlord. And so if the liquidator's decision wasn't capable of challenge under section 168, subsection 5, by the landlord, then he simply wouldn't be able to challenge the decision, and Parliament can't have been taken to have conferred such a power on a liquidator without providing some means for the landlord to challenge it. So it's very much in a category of its own.
Andrew, the one other thing I thought we might just touch on is we've argued this issue twice at first instance, twice in the Court of Appeal and then in the Supreme Court. And I just wondered whether you had any reflections on how the advocacy in the Supreme Court is different or evolved as against the earlier occasions on which we had to argue this issue.
Yes, I think obviously those who appear in the Supreme Court often will know that there is a need when you're dealing with a case such as this, which had not, as far as we're aware, reached the Supreme Court on standing a bankrupt has to challenge his trustee's decisions. And so it was necessary to dig pretty deep into the legislative history behind Section 303 of the Insolvency Act and its predecessors. And for that purpose, we were very grateful to Gretel Scott, the junior in Chambers, who did that research. And in fact, her efforts were noted by Lord Richards, who said, "I'm grateful to counsel for the appellant for their research into the state of bankruptcy law and practice as it existed before the enactment of the mid-19th century Bankruptcy Acts." I think that remark rewarded Gretel for spending the summer in Lincoln's Inn Library. So that was obviously worth doing in the Supreme Court, which we didn't do in the Court of Appeal. The other thing we did in the Supreme Court was we compared the law in England and Wales with that in other Commonwealth jurisdictions and had an equally interesting analysis of how different jurisdictions dealt with the same problem. Although I don't remember all the detail, I do remember that Australia in particular have a much more flexible approach to standing. And maybe Mr. and Mrs. Brake would have succeeded in Australia where they didn't in this country. So what's interesting is that having succeeded at first instance with very splendid extempore judgment from Judge Matthews, his reasoning was upheld in a very detailed, impressive judgment in the Supreme Court. And essentially, the basic point is that so far as bankrupts are concerned, unless they can show that there is or is likely to be a surplus in the bankruptcy, it's going to be very difficult indeed for them to challenge the decisions of their trustees.
And what's striking, I think, about Lord Richards' analysis is it's a framework that applies to corporate insolvency and to creditors and shareholders as well. Well, we hope you've found this podcast interesting and useful, and no doubt there will be more cases in this space grappling with Lord Richard's framework in the future. Thank you for listening.
You can find out more about recent cases in which members of 3VB have been involved and further information on all our areas of practice by visiting our website www.3vb.com or via our LinkedIn page and Twitter feed at 3VB Chambers.